Let's go.
Choke points. Brought to you by Toyota of Puyallup. Let's talk ferries. You may need to start preparing for disruptions and schedule changes because of the construction at Coleman Dock. There's a lot going on down there. What's the schedule look like?
Well, the schedule looks like we still have a couple more years of construction to deal with. But over the next month, the final pieces of the old Coleman Dock terminal building are going to be torn down. It's almost completely gone, but they're finishing up that demo. But to finish that up, the ferry riders are going to have to deal with some short-term pain.
All the vessels coming in and out of Coleman Dock, going to Bainbridge Island or going to Bremerton, will be sailing out of one slip.
The ferry system, Sharon Gavin, says all sailings will be working on a temporary schedule from January 4th to January 20th on those runs out of Coleman Dock, which could make for significant delays.
Most of the sailings change between, say, 5 and 15 minutes. However, later in the afternoon, early evenings, schedules may change up to an hour.
So ferry directors don't want the boats backing up at Coleman Dock, and there are a few places where the boats can't actually pass each other because of their sizes and the wakes that two boats would toss out and potentially do some damage to the shoreline. So Coleman Dock has had similar one-slip operations in the past. The last one was over the summer, but it only lasted a few days. This is going to be more than 2 weeks.
It's something that a lot of our customers are used to, but they may not remember it, or they may have an old schedule, and this is a slightly different schedule, so we want to make sure that we're getting that out well in advance so that people can be prepared for the changes.
Now, Gavin says they chose this low-volume time of the year to complete this bigger phase of work on the dock to keep the disruptions to a minimum. She says it's not really easy to completely renovate the state's largest ferry terminal while keeping the service going.
This will allow us to finish tearing down the rest of the old terminal, drive the piles in that will then hold the deck for the rest of the new terminal.
Gavin asks that you check out the temporary sailing schedule over the holiday. Make sure you know what to expect in January, and she does appreciate your patience.
By allowing us to be able to take these 2 weeks and do the one-slip operations, it helps us with making sure that we are, you know, staying on with the schedule that we have.
This $455 million renovation project still has about 3 years left of work before it's done, so this will not be the last change to your regular ferry routine there at Coleman Dock. You can check out the temporary sailing schedule at mynorthwest.com and get familiar with it, because as Sharon said, later in the evening, some of those runs may be pushed by as much as of an hour there based on that one slip operation.
That is a real jigsaw puzzle. Do they have a passenger-only ferry, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, and the two passenger-only ferries, you know, the Kitsap and the King County ones, have now moved to a slip a little bit further to the south. That new terminal opened a couple months ago, I believe. So they now have their own dedicated area just to the south of Coleman Dock. It's funny. A jigsaw puzzle. It's so funny. You tear down part of the deck, you move the parking to here.
Yeah.
You tear down that other part, you move parking over there.
Have you taken the Bremerton Ferry lately?
No, not super lately.
I took it, I guess it was a couple of months ago, and it wasn't at all. I mean, even if you've lived here all your life, you have to practice getting there. Unless you do it every day. It was an amazing labyrinth to get there.
Well, that and also just the changes we've had on Alaskan Way.
That's what I mean.
Too, with the construction with there, too. You're like, okay, can I turn here? Can I not turn here? Uh-oh. Yeah, so there's a lot going on there. And, yeah, it's, yeah. I mean, what are you going to do?
Well, the ultimate plan is when Alaskan Way is finally finished, this will be a piece of cake, right?
Yeah, oh, definitely. I mean, we're going to have, an eight-lane boulevard there, and then you're going to have dedicated ferry terminal lanes and things like that. But we've got 3 more years worth of work on both of those projects, really, to get that thing going. But, yeah, check it out, the schedule, because you're going to come back from the holiday, and you don't want Jan 4 to be like, what? So, yeah, be ready.
Every year, Car Radio raises money for Treehouse. It's our Holiday Magic campaign. Treehouse is a place where foster kids get the things that most families can take for granted, like a family-style Christmas. And the great thing around here is that there is a huge community standing by to fill in those gaps. Among them, a certain celebrity chef who always seems to show up when there's a good cause that needs support. Here's Car Radio's Aaron Grinillo.
Four aspiring young cooks meet up in a gourmet kitchen in downtown Seattle for a cooking class taught by local legend Chef Tom Douglas.
I've got my shallots, some white wine.
Douglas invited the youth from Treehouse as part of the nonprofit's Launch Success Program, supporting foster youth as they age into adulthood.
It's really made me realize how easily attainable this dream is.
Journey has goals of becoming a chef herself one day.
It's not just a dream anymore. Like, I'm actually making my way there now.
On this day, as the holidays approach, the students learn how to properly cut and sear chicken, a simple lesson, Douglas says, that makes a big impact.
With foster kids, you're being shoved into somebody else's tradition, somebody else's household, somebody else's reason why they celebrate in this particular way. But I think the positive energy of making your own, of starting that tradition, understanding it's okay to create that for yourself, is really a positive, awesome thing, and I hope they take that away with them.
Treehouse defines success by steering youth toward a degree or a certificate, a living wage, and stable housing. Paris is on a path to achieve it all.
Hopefully in the near future, I plan to have different restaurants, like different foods, like burger joints, taco joints.
Paris says the cooking lesson inspired her to establish her own kitchen delivery business, a first step in reaching her goals. Treehouse and Douglas say they'll be there in the coming years as she transitions from foster care to becoming an entrepreneur.
You have to find out what your end goal is to get through these tougher times, these areas where you're not as comfortable. So that's what I tell them, and that's what I like about Treehouse, is that it's the same thing. They're just there to support.
And you can support, too. Join Cairo Radio and Treehouse for another year of holiday magic. Text MAGIC to 98973 to find out how you can help make the holidays bright for kids in foster care.
And one great way you can help Treehouse is to go on the installment plan where you just have a regular monthly donation taken out of your charge card. You get points. Yes, I get points. And
it's a win-win.
You also support a great cause.
Yeah, you just have to text MAGIC to 98973 to get a link to learn how to donate. I happen to catch, you know, all these stories are so great. And it's more than enough reason to donate to Treehouse. But I happen to catch an exchange between Treehouse and one of their foster youth on Twitter yesterday. She's now a grown adult, but mm-hmm. she posted a picture of herself as a young girl, pigtails and all, big smile. And Treehouse was saying, thank you for your support. But she said, no, thank you for giving my younger self a chance at experiencing childhood, for providing me with clothes so I could feel more normal and less outcast, and for helping me not become another statistic, another homeless foster youth that didn't graduate high school or get a GED. And her her profile on Twitter indicates that she's into tech and gadgets and all that. So, you know, Treehouse helped her succeed in life. And of the thousands of foster kids in our state that also need help, that's what your donations will support today.
So give some money and do it now. And you can also volunteer because they're always looking for people to help as tutors and just to make life a little more normal. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. The Washington State Legislature is going to take up gun control in the coming session. So I thought we would talk with James Densley. He's a co-founder of the Violence Project, and they have conducted a study of mass shootings. How many shootings did you study, James?
We looked at mass shootings from 1966 through to 2019, and there's 171 mass shooters in our database in that period.
Okay, and you divide them into five different profiles: K-12 shooters, college and university shooters, workplace shooters, place of worship shooters, and shooters at a commercial location. And they have these various profiles, which we can go over. But the thing that I wanted to ask you about, because we're going to be discussing it here in Washington once again this year, is the availability of guns. To what extent does the availability of weapons make a mass shooting more likely? Is it a key component in that, did you find?
It is. It is a key component. We've put together a model of sort of why we feel like mass shootings are occurring. We see it as a four-step process. Many of these individuals have got a history of childhood trauma and exposure to violence at a young age. The second piece is that they generally reach a sort of identifiable crisis point in their lives. And that can be being fired from work, or it could be bullying at school. But it's usually some sort of almost suicidal crisis. We actually see a lot of overlap between suicide and homicide here. The third factor is that there's a kind of script for this type of violence. And what we mean by that is that mass shooters can become inspired by other mass shooters. They research them and they mimic and replicate them. And then the fourth factor is access to firearms. So of the four pieces, we see firearms as really very important.
Well, I guess it's obvious. We're studying shooters, so obviously they have access to firearms. But in looking for a way to make them less likely, is controlling those firearms a reasonable way to go about it?
It's definitely a key component. I don't think it's the whole picture. I think there's a lot more we can do in other areas as well around sort of suicide prevention, crisis intervention, mental health. But the firearms are important. I'll give you a few examples why. For 80% of school shooters in our data, they got their firearms from family members. They stole them. And this, to us, speaks to the need for safe storage in homes and better education around what it means to be a gun owner and how to take care of those firearms safely and securely so that young people can't get access to them. And there'll be a diffusion of benefits from that. It won't just prevent mass shootings and school shootings. It'll also prevent accidental deaths in the home, and it will prevent suicides as well, because we know that the proximity to a firearm is a major factor in those issues.
And give me that percentage again, the percentage that steal the weapon from home.
80% of school shootings.
80%, wow. But then it sounds like legal weapons sales then are not as big a factor.
So I think there's still some gaps in the existing system, which would speak to the need for kind of universal background checks. Because we also have examples of people who maybe would have failed some sort of legal process in their own state, but all they did is just cross the border and go to a different state to access their weapons. And so we need this on a uniform level. We need those universal background checks. The other thing we see in our data, which speaks to the legal ownership of firearms, is the need for things like red flag laws. Because what we see is a number of individuals who are in crisis, who are clearly struggling, not necessarily mentally ill, but they're also not mentally well either. And red flag laws provide a little bit of a pause. We think about someone in crisis as like a balloon ready to pop. And all you need to do is let a little bit of air out, and a little bit of time and space can be just enough to get somebody through that crisis. Things like red flag laws, things like wait periods, these things provide that time and space.
So, as a member of the media, I'm curious as to how the media either helps or exacerbates this problem. Were you able to track the effect of media coverage on these shooters forming the intent either to do something or preventing them from doing something?
A lot of the mass shootings in our database clustered around each other in time and in space. And it seemed to be particularly high-profile mass shootings that got a lot of media attention would then result in other mass shootings that would follow. And we see a number of individuals as well planting what we would call legacy tokens. So what that means is manifestos or videos, social media postings. We see that increasing in recent years. It seems to be that there's a quest for notoriety among some mass shooters, and it's tied to the media coverage that they can command.
That's what I was afraid of. So is there something, in the mainstream media, we could do something about that by covering it less, but more and more, we don't matter. It's online media, and there's no restrictions on that.
Yeah, we think for the online platforms, we know that there have been some cases in recent years of mass shootings that have been motivated by hate, misogyny, religious hatred, etc. And a lot of that kind of radicalization toward those acts has occurred on the internet. So I think we need to do a much better job of holding social media companies and platforms accountable for the content that they have online, recognizing, of course, that we have freedom of speech and there's a sensitive balance to be made. But there's a lot of content out there on the internet that for people who are in crisis and for people who are vulnerable, this is the type of information that's going to motivate them toward violence. Deplatforming a lot of hate groups, for example, and disrupting their activities online.
The Violence Project, which you co-founded, is using research to try and bring some objective analysis to this. Do you have any buy-in from the gun rights people? And based on your work, do you see the possibility of coming to a political solution that has the support of the NRA as well as the gun control people?
People, I think, on the left and on the right have been able to take aspects of this research and realize that mass shootings are not an inevitability. It's not something that we should just accept as a daily part of our routine in American society. Instead, there are things that we can do, and there are things that we can do which don't have to infringe upon people's Second Amendment rights, that don't have to fundamentally change the social fabric of America, but are just common sense steps that most people can agree on.
James Densley is the co-founder of the Violence Project in St. Paul, Minnesota, which is behind this new study. He also teaches criminal justice at Metropolitan State University. James, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's time for the Daily Dose of Kindness now. It's from our news partners at Cairo 7 TV. Michael Spears found a very special Secret Santa, ready to surprise kids at a local Target.
An evening of shopping.
What's going on?
That may be at the top of any 12's wish list.
What's happening? How y'all doing?
Good!
Seahawks legend Cliff Averill and his foundation made it happen for a group of lucky kids from Odessa Brown.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you too.
And he brought along a few friends to help.
Michael Spears.
I was one of the volunteers Santa had included.
I want...
Rules were simple.
$250.
Spend it all.
Record yourself. Now flip it.
You got the AirPods, the video game.
And not just on themselves.
And then this for my sister.
They had to get something else for someone else in their family.
For Cliff Averill, that was the cool part. An all-around lesson in giving back to others.
When they get to whatever success looks like for them, to give back as well. I think it's all about teaching them, you know, the right way of going about things. And also... it's the holiday season. I think all kids should have something for Christmas.
Ah, it seems like the most fun out of having NFL money, huh? Being able to do that, walk into,
that's,
you know, because
right.
We heard, was it Bobby Wagner, who was at the West Seattle Safeway, and just decided he was picking up groceries for people living in tiny home villages, and then decided, you know what, I'm going to buy everybody's groceries for the next half hour. You know, yeah. Oh, it just sounds like fun. So good on Cliff Averill, and Michael Bennett was there as well.
Time for the Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle. Here is Stacy Rost. Did you see this dinner receipt, Stacy, from Daniels?
I did. What was it? $17,000?
$17,579.10. And this was I guess they call it a hazing dinner. For the defensive backs on the Seahawks, and of course the rookies were told to pay. Do you know how many were at the dinner?
I don't. If I'm going to assume it's just the defensive backs, let's say there's like 8 guys there, maybe.
Oh, well, then that's reasonable. I can see how.
Right, exactly.
I don't see a tip line here, though, so I'm assuming the tip added to that bill.
Oh, gosh. I have to think that's the case, too. A tip for a $17,000 dinner.
I don't even know the names of some of these alcohols that they bought. That probably tells you something about my salary.
Cognac. Same. Cognac.
$11,000 worth of Louis the 13th.
Yeah, it's $4,000 a bottle. It's cognac.
Oh, is that cognac? Okay, well, see? Then, okay. There you go.
So
but you have to think about it, too. That means there's $6,000 worth of just food that they had.
Yeah. Well, they're big boys. They
you know what lobster and steak cost these days at Daniel's, Stacey?
I guess. God, are you ordering like 5 a piece?
Well, maybe.
Maybe.
Well, I figured it out. I figured it out based on, let's see, the two rookies who paid were Amadi, whose salary is $3.1 million over 4 years, and Blair, whose salary is $6.2 million. So that was about, 4 days pay for Blair and about a week's pay for Amadi.
Oh, man.
Yep.
So.
Yep.
That's no big deal.
You know. That's something you can absorb pretty easily.
Good for them, though. It's nice to see people enjoying them. I mean, it sounds ridiculous to most of us, a $17,000 bill. But, I mean, what more is there in life besides a good meal with great friends?
Yeah, imagine that it was like $800. It's still a lot. But $17,000 for most people would be like absolutely insane. Also, the rookies were joking about it. Like Amadi posted a screenshot of it with kind of a laughing emoji face to Twitter. So I don't know. It seems like they had a good time.
Yeah. So we were facing Arizona on Sunday, and they're pretty lousy this year, right?
Yeah, I think they're better than their record, but overall Seattle's better on paper in almost every category.
Are the games decided on paper, Stacey, or are they decided on the field?
It's a great question, Dave. You know, well, that's okay. So for my three questions article that I had for 710sports.com, I mentioned the fact that they just have a weird history between these two teams. And part of that is, do I think that there's like some weird kind of written in the stars things going on between these two teams? No. But if you're taking anything actually kind of like concrete stuff you can take away from it, it's A, that the Cardinals are better than their record, and B, that your divisional opponent always knows you better than anyone else. So I think that kind of lends itself to some weirder games or closer games than you were expecting.
So beware Arizona is what you're saying. Now what do we know about, do we know what the roster is going to be on Sunday, who's ready to play and who's not?
We don't yet. It sounds as though Quandre Diggs is a maybe like a long shot. He's going to be a game day decision, but he has a high ankle sprain, which takes some guys like 4 to 5 weeks or longer to recover from. Pete Carroll kind of hinted it wouldn't take him maybe that long, but I would not expect him to play Sunday. I'd be surprised if he did, especially now that they have a playoff spot locked up. Or the playoff berth locked up. Like, you don't want to risk one of your best defensive backs getting injured. So I would think you'd see Lano Hill back there with Bradley McDougald. And then Bobby Wagner is kind of a maybe. I think I'd lean toward expecting him to play, but I wouldn't be shocked to see Cody Barton kind of come in too to kind of help with that load.
So you mean they're not looking at this as a must win then?
I mean, it's not a must win for the playoffs, but it is a must win for the number one seed, which I think this team really
wants.
Which
has an important advantage, right? Doesn't that give you home field?
Oh,
exactly. It gives you home field throughout the entire playoffs.
Although now that I think about it, their road record is better than their home record. So maybe they want home field advantage. Maybe they should just throw this game.
Yeah, but the three times they've been to the Super Bowl is when they had the number one seed. So, yeah.
All the pieces are coming together now.
It's all making sense.
So at what point do the players allow themselves to start thinking Super Bowl at this point? Or is there as much superstition in football as there is in baseball?
Oh, my gosh. I think athletes in general, maybe baseball players more, but are among the most superstitious people. I also think that Pete Carroll preaches to this team on the regular, know the truth. The truth is we're in the playoffs and that we need to win these two games to get the number one seed. That's the truth. But the reality is that we need to play week by week, and we can't look by a certain team. And we are, it sounds kind of like cliche, but we're 1-0 every week. And that's kind of been their formula, and it works for them. And you have to follow that mindset to succeed. And I think that I would guess that anytime they get overconfident, it kind of comes back to bite them. So the goal is you don't look past Arizona. The reality is you don't need the win to just get in the playoffs, but you cannot look past them.
Stacy Ross, our Sports Insider. Stacy, thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. We go live now to former acting CIA director Michael Morrell, who is the host of Intelligence Matters, which you can hear Saturdays on Cairo Radio. And we haven't had a chance to talk since the Inspector General's report was released on the origins of the FBI's Operation Crossfire Hurricane, which was the investigation of tampering in the 2016 election. And, Mike, while they found that there was no bias involved, they did find what it sounds to me were like fairly serious mistakes in the paperwork they filed to get these surveillance warrants from the secret FISA court. And one in particular, which has provoked a lot of commentary, was the authorization to tap Carter Page on the grounds he had Russian contacts, when it turns out that he also apparently was serving as a source on Russia for the CIA. Now, it sounds like one part of the government didn't know what the other part of the government was doing.
Right. Dave, this is a very significant Inspector General report. I'd say the two things they found that I thought were important on the one side of the coin was no political bias and an absolutely legitimate reason to open an investigation of the Trump campaign. So those were the, you know, one side of the coin. On the other side of the coin, as you say, they did find significant errors, inappropriate steps that were taken in the Carter Page FISA application. And what they found was that the to put it in to summarize it, I think, is to say that the FBI put as much information in there that made their case that he needed to be surveilled, and they did not put information in there that would be exculpatory, that would be a reason not to surveil him. And it is their responsibility to do both. And the CIA information is a great example of that. The CIA did inform the FBI that Carter Page had been, it ended in 2013, but had been a contact for the agency. Whenever he went to Russia, he would come back and tell the agency what he saw, what he heard. He didn't do operational acts for the agency, but he just told the agency what he saw. Mm-hmm. The agency told the FBI that they did not put that in the FISA application. They should have. I'll tell you, when
on, that's an important detail. So, and I wasn't aware of that. So Carter Page was providing information to the CIA, but that relationship ended in 2013, long before the election? I see.
Correct. All right. Correct. But still, it needed to be in the FISA application, right? Okay. This was somebody who was helping his government with a very important matter, and the FBI did not tell the judge about that. The other thing I'd say about this is, as deputy director of CIA and then acting director of CIA, I had to sign off on many FISA applications. So the CIA, in addition to the FBI, the CIA asked the FISA court for permission to surveil. And what the CIA asked for is permission to surveil foreigners in the United States. You still need a warrant even though it's a foreigner. So we do plenty of FISA applications as well, and they would come through my office, and I would have to read them, and I would have to sign at the back that everything in there was true and everything that needed to be in there was in there. And I took that responsibility extraordinarily seriously. I asked a lot of questions. What about this? What about that? And I think that the FBI needs that kind of thoroughness anytime that they do a FISA application.
So in this case, the person who deliberately left out that exculpatory information, is that person in trouble?
So I would hope so. I would hope that that person would face consequences. Now, what those consequences would be, that's up to the FBI. Yeah. And that's up to the FBI management, right, what to do about that person. If I had a person at CIA who did that, I would think about terminating them. At minimum, I might reduce them in grade. I might make sure they didn't get a promotion for the next X number of years. So I would take this very seriously, because you need to send a signal to everybody else that thoroughness and completeness in these FISA applications is extraordinarily important.
So on the other aspect of this, which has caused a lot of debate, the Steele dossier.
Yes.
This is the one that had all those lurid details. Can we now say with certainty that that was all made up, a complete fabrication, or not?
So I don't know that. What I do know is that because, I mean, I've read it a number of times, and my conclusion after I read it is I don't know what's true that's in there, and I don't know what's false that's in there, because the dossier does not contain the sourcing. How was it that Steele came to understand a particular fact? Who told him? What was the chain of acquisition? Was it somebody who actually saw documents? Was it somebody who actually was working on the matter today? Or was it somebody who talked? Was it a retired person who talked to another retired person who talked to a current person who talked to a current person? What was the chain of acquisition like? None of that is in there. So from the first time I read it, I had no idea what was true and what wasn't. And I'm still in that position. And I think that's why the intelligence community didn't use any of it at all in their assessment of Russian interference in the election.
So that had no place in the Russia investigation then?
It had no place in the intelligence community's assessment of what Russia did in 2016. It clearly played a role in these FISA applications, right? There are references to the Steele dossier. So whether that's appropriate or not, I don't know, because I wasn't there at the time and I didn't know how they were thinking about the Steele dossier. But I never gave it a lot of credibility.
Okay, one more issue which just surfaced this morning. I don't know if you saw the New York Times report this morning on surveillance, but they apparently acquired the database of a private company which tracks literally everybody using a cell phone. They provided animated maps over 24 hours that show the human traffic at various sites, such as Grand Central Station, such as the Pentagon, such as the White House. And you see these little dots clustering and then dissipating, and clustering and then dissipating over these, shall we call them, targets where this information to get into the wrong hands. And the Times is basically saying that we would, if a government said, by the way, we have decided to require everybody above the age of 12 to carry a tracking device that reveals your location 24 hours a day, we would say that we were in a police state. Well, we were in the equivalent thing, except it's run by a private company. And they actually suggest wrapping your cell phone in aluminum foil to stop this from going on. So as a, you know, former spy yourself, what do you think about this?
Yeah, so there are a lot of, this is a great question. There are a lot of private companies who are developing intelligence-like capabilities. And this is a great example of that. And there are others. There are companies out there who are doing facial recognition. I just saw an ad the other day for a camera that you can put on your lapel, and it'll show up on your iWatch who the person is when you're standing talking to somebody. So there's all these intelligence-like capabilities out there. If governments use them, right, if the U.S. government were using this database that the New York Times wrote about, they would be breaking the law. But since it's a private company, they're not. So I think there needs to be a very serious discussion by Congress on how do we regulate these private intelligence capabilities that are starting to proliferate. How do we regulate them in order to protect the privacy of American citizens?
Former acting CIA director Mike Morrell, he's the host of Intelligence Matters. You can hear it Saturdays right here on Cairo Radio. Mike, thanks very much. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.